Tonight on Arena, we welcome a new gallery to Kilkenny with the exhibition Bloods, and Andreas Barba describes his luminous republic. You can text 51551 with your comments or tweet at RTE Arena. Last month, writer and director Philip Doherty spoke to us on Arena about his new film Redemption of a Rogue, which has since won two major awards at the Galway Film FLA for Best Irish Film and Best Irish First Feature. Now he's back with Fiach, a new piece of drive-in theatre which not only keeps the audience in their cars, but is in essence one long frantic car chase between a guard and a criminal. The drama takes place in the car park in Ballinahown, Connemara, and is produced by Fibbean Theatre Company in association with Antaivyark. Philip Doherty joins me now from Galway. So, Philip, this is theatre, but it's drive-in theatre. Motor cars are central to the whole event. What can the audience expect from this spectacle that's Fiach?
Well, I think it's a strange but exciting hybrid between a theatre show, a radio play, because a lot of the sound and dialogue and music will be coming through the car stereo, and a rock concert because of the camera setup and the live editing of the performances, which are live, and I suppose live cinema because of the genre, the style and the projection onto a massive screen.
And what can you tell us about the set? As I said, cars play a big role in this production.
Yeah, I guess we're trying to think outside the box because Fibbean had a number of shows planned this year and they were scrapped with everything else because of the COVID-19, and myself and Fibbean's manager Dara Couturis were kind of thinking of ideas, and we came up with the idea of a drive-in theatre show, and the idea of the audience being safe in their car watching the show, and what would be more exciting, I think, for an audience sitting in their car but to watch a car chase in their car, and that immersive feel. And then the idea of a car chase really appealed to me, especially the idea of a Garda chasing a criminal. It's something I've always wanted to see in a film, but I've never seen it, because you always see it in, like, in Hollywood films, the cops and robbers and tough detectives chasing the gangsters, but never a Garda. So I never thought my wildest dreams would be making a theatre show with that. So
you as the writer then had to create these characters. Tell us about the Ban Garda and the criminal, who is Fiach.
Yeah, so the title of the show is Fiach, but it's a little bit of a red herring, I guess, because the Fiach means hunt, and the lead character in it is Cliona Brady, and she's chasing the criminal called Fiach. Cliona Brady is a very strong and, you know, tough character. She's a protector, and she's not afraid to dish out tough love to anyone who crosses her. So she comes across this notorious criminal called Fiach, and she starts chasing him, and as she starts gathering information, interrogating and digging about him, she realises that they've got a deep connection, that they've both suffered a similar grief, and they both suffer a similar guilt about that grief. So it actually turns into something else. Instead of just stopping and arresting the criminal, it turns into a race against time to save his life.
Now, there are some other characters in the show, and Cliona's phone never stops ringing with various people contacting her. What can you tell us about the other characters?
Yeah, so Cliona Brady, who's played wonderfully by Fionnuala Flaherty, the actress, so she's on this journey, on this trip, so there's all these obstacles in her way as she's trying to stop Fiach in his journey. All these different characters start kind of ringing in on her. So there, even though it's a two-hander, essentially, with two live actors on stage, Fiach being played by Dara Devaney, there is a world of characters, and very rural characters, populated by kind of strange and mad characters who are constantly challenging her. And all those have been pre-recorded, so it is populated by a vast, there is a scale to the show as well, and they will be constantly interrupting her journey in the show and in the production.
So that sounds a very intricate audio element to the show. So how is that? Is that done through speakers, or is it done through car radios, or how is that? How does that work, or is it a mixture?
Yeah, it's a mixture. I think most of the sound, 90% of it, will be through the car stereo. And I mentioned it being kind of like a radio play before because, you know, a lot of the dialogue will be sort of the actors, you will hear them very intimately and their words being drip fed into the audience's ears. But there are elements where it will be external speakers for a lot of the car chase sounds and car screechers and engines. So we are trying to make it as dynamic as possible. We've got a brilliant team there. But it is... I guess it's a ballet between a lot of technical things, from the visuals, from the sound design, from the live performance. And I'm, you know, it's new territory for us, but I think it's going to be a really exciting experience for audiences.
Yes, and reading the script, there's also action around the cars. Not everything, it's not all looking at the stage as such or listening on your car phone.
Yeah,
characters
that's right.
Might pop up near
yeah,
your car.
Yes, the mice pop up around your car, that's for sure. So I guess one of the things I love about theatre is the live element and the experiential element. So when you go into the theatre, the show starts. So I wanted the audience to feel like they're in the world of the play. But yeah, there are a lot of surprises in it. And the lighting design is not just on the stage. It's completely surrounding the audiences and in the car. So we're using everything we can to make a thrilling performance for the audience.
So what are the logistics? I guess you have to have a car. You have to go by car.
Yeah, you do. You come in a car and you sit back and enjoy the show for people in their own comfortable car seats.
A
working radio would be good.
How many cars do you think you can accommodate at each show?
Yeah, I think we're very lucky at Fee Beam because we've got a large car park, so at least 30 cars, but we'll be aiming to get more than that in. But we're at the moment, the capacity is 30 cars, so how many people you can fit in a car around that, I guess, too comfortably in the driver's seat and the passenger seat. And we're doing shows at night time, so it starts at 10 o'clock and we're doing midnight shows over the weekend. So the visuals really pop out on the billboard. And I think come in your car and it'll be an interesting a different experience, hopefully.
And is it, what about rain or bad weather conditions? How robust is it in that regard?
Yeah, no, that's it. That's a good question. So I've done lots of outdoor theatre before and there was lots of prayers and candles being lit to make sure that the sun comes out. So I've learnt my lesson a little bit. It doesn't matter if it rains actually in this because people will be inside in their car. Maybe the actors might get wet for a short period of time, but that won't affect. In fact, it could actually enhance the sensory experience with the rain coming down. It might give it a more of a film noir feel.
So, Philip, when did you write this? I mean, how does this tally with your writing and directing Redemption of a Rogue?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting past few months, actually. It was quite busy, but Redemption of a Rogue, it was a wonderful thing to happen to get it into the Galway Film Fla and to have the film completed and then to win the two awards was just wonderful for everyone involved, and it was such a passion project. But I was juggling the two. But I guess this story, once we decided the concept on it and the car chase element, the lead character, Cliona, and what she was doing, it kind of wrote itself, and it was something I really, really enjoyed writing. I mean, during the lockdown, I think a lot of people flourished in making art in all forms, but especially writers, and this is the story I wrote during the COVID-19 lockdown.
And I guess people will know from mentioning on Taivyark and Fibine that the play is in Irish.
Yeah, the play is in Irish. Dara Devaney and Fionnuala Flaherty are two of the best Irish language actors in the country, but it is accessible to anyone who speaks English or Irish. So there are surtitles in it. And because of the nature of the kind of cinema element, the surtitles are a part of the design and part of the spectacle of the show.
Going back again to Redemption of a Rogue, it was a great success to win those two awards at the Galway Film Fla. I mean, I guess you were surprised, but at the same time, it was a very popular show.
Yeah, no, it's a surprise for sure. I think it's my first film, so to get it over the line was just a real joy, I have to say, and I'm just so thankful to all the people that helped making that happen. But then to pick up two awards, I didn't imagine that happening. And I guess, you know, I won't lie to you, it was absolutely euphoric feeling, so it was. And I was on cloud nine for quite a while. probably too long, but I overstayed my welcome. But it was just great for everyone involved in it. It was something we did in the rain about 18 months ago in January. So a lot of hard work went into it, and it's just lovely to recognise
yes,
for it.
People might remember it's based in on the border in Cavan, and Aaron Monahan's character returns to try and put right some wrongs, and it's a roller coaster of events befall him when he comes back to his local town.
Yeah, it is. It's a black comedy set, and I'm from Cavan originally, so it's set in this kind of purgatory, where it's rain-sodden purgatory, where the main character, Jimmy Cullen, goes through this sort of Christ-like passionate journey, and it's wonderfully played by one of Ireland's top actors, Aaron Monahan. But the response has been really amazing, I have to say, because you really don't know when you're making these things what the response is going to be. You can just do something that you love and that excites you, but the reaction to it is just, I don't know, it's blown us all away, so we're absolutely thrilled.
And what's next for it?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. I don't think anyone's... We'd love to have a longer festival run and then a cinema release, hopefully by later in the year, by the end of the year. That's the plan, but everything keeps changing at the moment. But there's a lot of really great interest in it, and Wildcard are doing the distribution for it. So, yeah, it's something we'll be looking out for. But, yeah, I can't wait to see what that journey will be either.
Well, best of luck with the future of Redemption of a Rogue. And Fiac, your new show runs from the 12th to the 22nd of August in Ballinahown, Connemara. Full details from fibbean.com.
You're listening to Arena.
Andreas Barba is the author of 12 novels, including Such Small Hands and The Right Intention. His most recent novel, A Luminous Republic, is a story set in San Cristobal, a city built at the mouth of subtropical jungle somewhere in South America. The city's citizens are living in fear of a group of 32 hungry and dirty children who live wild in the jungle and come into the city to steal and in time to terrorise and flummox the citizens. Into this town comes our narrator, an outsider who becomes fascinated with the children while his job as a civil servant demands that he brings them to justice. I'm joined now by the author Andreas Barba. You're very welcome, Andreas. You're known for writing quite chilling novels, and A Luminous Republic is no exception. In the foreword written by Edmund White, he writes, a Hollywood hack would describe it as Lord of the Flies meets Heart of Darkness. Tell us about the premise of the novel.
The very beginning, the idea was making kind of a dystopian tale of what would happen if a bunch of kids arrived to a small town and putting compromise all this mythological thinking that we've made about childhood in general. And that was the starting point of the book. And crossing with a documentary film I saw on the community, a child community who live in the subway in Russia. So the crash of these two elements made me think about a novel that could like make it together.
Yes, because the book, after a particularly gruesome episode in the town, the children vanish for some time. People assume they're hiding in the jungle, fending for themselves. There's examples through history, isn't there, of these kind of feral children raised by wolves or by cattle. Did those mythological episodes or stories influence the story?
Yeah, well, this... two like very, very interesting points in your question. One is this mythological tale of a child that is being born, raised by animals maybe, or the very same nature, that comes from the Enlightenment in the French Revolution. And it comes hand by hand with the official Western Dead of God, in which we inaugurate the myth of childhood as a paradise lost in one hand, and in the other hand we create the building of the educational institution to make the kids adults as soon as possible. So this contradictory thing is in one hand in that perspective of the childhood as a fiction as a myth, and on the other hand, as you said, I was very attracted by the idea of constructing the whole structure of the novel around a void, something that is not there anymore. So this bunch of kids arrived to this town, made something violent, and after that they just disappear. And this small town is left alone trying to figure out what happened there and how that affected to them in terms of like cultural thinking or on childhood, you know.
So the children have are very particular in how they interact with each other. First of all, there are no leaders, and then they have a particular language. Talk to us a little bit about how you constructed the society these children have created for themselves.
Yeah, I think all the novels that in some point are related with the notion of childhood feel the temptation of talking about how is made the structure of a community or a society. You can see that, of course, in Lord of the Flies, for instance, but you can see also that in Peter Pan, for example. So for a moment, I was thinking, well, this is a good chance for me to make a political novel on how a society can be restructured on something that is not working anymore or something like that. So I start thinking how would be a good way to approach that element. And I thought that it could be insects in some point. So I started reading all these books by Maurice Maeterlinck on the life of the bees and the life of the ants and all these things. And I thought for a moment that it could be a very interesting intersection in utopian anarchist thinking and the life of the insects in the other hand. So I just crossed these two things in something that I don't know if it works, but I had a lot of fun doing that.
Yes, because there's this idea that they have their own language. And as I say, they don't have a leader. But also, as much as they are 32 children that disappear, there are also the children of St. Cristobal, the children who live with their parents, the children, the conventional children who are living the mythological life, you say, that we have created around children. And the fact that these children once existed and now have disappeared have a fundamental effect on them. What was the thinking about how their existence would affect ordinary or conventional children?
Well, there is something that is very, very related with this Enlightenment thinking about how should be an educational system. Is after we have constructed this building, we have to recognize that in the very end, what we have is a huge fear of what happened when the kids are absolutely alone and without the surveillance of an adult. So actually, in some way, all this institutional educational system is made for us to protect ourselves from children, not to protect children from the dangers of the world, but to protect ourselves of who the children are when they are alone. That is something that I think is very appealing as a notion, because, the kids are, in some way, they're always trying to please to the adult. And there is kind of a fake relation between adults and kids all the time, because we know they're trying to please and they know we're trying to educate them. And there's like a hierarchical relation, if you will, but at the same time it's a hiding thing all the time. So I think we need to recognize as an adult that we are scared of kids, what the kids do when they're alone. You can see that, for instance, in how scared are we when we need to think about violence, when violence is just something that happened among kids, not with the intervention of an adult, how we are scared of this type of kind of, you can name it like P pure violence that happened like out of the cultural statements that we make when we think on violence as an adult. So I don't know. I mean, all these things are in the book in a way, but this element of fear is so present all the time.
So this idea that children are innocent human beings, yeah, is really what you're exploring in the book.
That's probably the worst lie ever, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this innocence is also a myth that we have constructed in order to think that we have been already in paradise when we were kids.
Then when people see these wild children who can create their own society, who can threaten them, their inclination is to catch them, lock them up, because they really undermine everything they believe about children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in this sense, you can see very clearly the biggest influence of this book, that is Joseph Conrad writing. One of the subjects that is always in all every Joseph Conrad writing is this civilization versus I don't know, violence, if you will, or so it's always a battle that is not is never won by the representatives of the civilization in some way.
The other thing about the children being this other, this kind of strange thing that people are slightly wary of at the beginning, and then this builds up to fear. I know so many works of art at the moment are being compared to the situation we're in with this idea of the unknown and COVID-19 and this fear that we're all experiencing. Are there some parallels with that?
Well, there is. I think we are always scared of the other. I mean, the presence of the other is the main element that made us change, but that made us protect ourselves of the changing. And in this sense, this bunch of kids who arrived to San Cristobal represent, but I don't mean to write a symbolic novel at all. I mean, I was trying actually to write in a way a dystopian novel, but I realized at the very end that I wrote a utopian novel in a way that this community of kids that in the beginning seems to be like violence and they're challenging all the elements of the most basic civilization, at the very end, they are the representatives of the most hopeful approach to human thinking and, I don't know, community.
That the life that they create is rather fascinating and different and could actually work. Just to get back, but you have a background in teaching Spanish, I think. Can you describe, I mean, it must have been fun for you to create this language that the children had, which is a very simple language, really. They use the basics of Spanish and then just do things with the word to keep it exclusive to themselves.
Yeah, well, this that was one of the most fascinating things for me to write when I was writing the novel, and because I studied Spanish philology at college, and one of the most fascinating thing is how language is made, and this kind of magical moment in which someone points an object and says a name for the first time. Mm-hmm. That moment that is like the creational moment of everything, our connection with the world and our structure of thinking and everything. It was fascinating for me to think that though this community of kids could have made a new language to represent a world for the first time again. Because the past, the former language is no longer useful for them. That is something that I think we all have the experience. For instance, when we fall in love with someone, we kind of need to change the name for certain things. We need to change, for instance, the very name of the person we love. So this need of recreating, renaming things all the time, it was in the very core of the book as a political book, as a community book, how a community is made. A community need to name again all the things. So, yeah.
Well, the book is called The Luminous Republic and it's by Andres Barba and it's published by Granta. Thank you. Tomorrow, Kilkenny City officially gets a brand new museum. The Butler Gallery will be relocated from its original home in Kilkenny Castle to a 6 million facility in Evans Home on John's Quay in the heart of the city. And it will be a huge addition to the cultural capital of Kilkenny and the Midlands and, of course, Ireland itself. The opening exhibition comes courtesy of one of Ireland's leading photographers, Amelia Steen. It's entitled The Bloods and it's a photographic celebration of membership of the Irish Defence Forces. Amelia Steen joins me now, along with Anna O'Sullivan, director of the Butler Gallery. I'll talk to Anna about the wonderful new museum in a moment. But Amelia, tell me about the Bloods. As I say, it's about celebrating members of the Irish Defence Forces. How did it come about?
Hello, Kay, and thank you for having me on the programme.
So
it came about entirely by accident, as in my partner, Mick O'Dea, was a painter in residence during Kilkenny Arts Festival, and I was present in the barracks during that time, and some photographs were made, and I was given a tour of the barracks. The handball alley was shown to me, and I just knew that would make a perfect daylight studio, undistracted background, and a private space where which each person could enter in to be shot.
So it's an old traditional handball alley, is it, Amelia?
It is, and it's in a very good state of repair and a little door leading into it. So the people would wait outside and they were being shown the August Sander book, Portrait of Our Time. And they just appeared in through the doorway with whatever their tool of their profession, if you like, a sniper with a gun, a medic with his bag, a mechanic with his kit. And It just developed. It kind of expanded itself over a period of time.
Okay, so you were in the barracks when Mick O'Dea was doing his portraits in Kilkenny. Why then did you think, oh, the Defence Forces, and they will look so well in the ball alley? Tell me about the photographic eye that juxtaposed those two things.
That's an interesting one, Kay, because I didn't really think about it. I just approached it as in, shall we make some photographs? Let's see what they look like. How would it be with somebody standing in front of the camera and me taking the photograph? How intense could that experience be between myself, the photographer, and the subject? And please remember that members of the Defence Forces are trained to for ceremonial duty. So people hold and stand themselves in a most particular manner. So I think it was it was one of those things that just rolled onto itself. And there were some very interesting people in the barracks at that time, and we got on as people, and that's what drove the project.
Well, let's go to the individual people you photographed in a moment. But first, Anna, as director of the Butler Gallery, how big an occasion is this for you? Because I know what a great dream this was for you to move from the castle to this new venue. Describe the venue and how long a project has it been?
Well, the Butler Gallery has been around since 1943, and from the very beginning in its constitution, there was always a goal to find a home of one's own. And while we've been happily ensconced in Kilkenny Castle for 44 years, we've never had enough space to show off our collection and facilitate our diverse learning and public engagement programme. So this has been a long-term goal of many executives and boards of the gallery. But for the last 15 years since I've been director, we've been working on finding this new home, and the Kilkenny County Council, which are our great collaborators in this project, gave us Evans Home, which is a former almshouse built in 1818, right in the middle of Kilkenny City behind the Carnegie Library. Some people might not have ever seen it because at the front it was surrounded by trees and now it's been cut back and can see the wonderful gravitas of the building. And it has been restored beautifully by McCullough Mulvan Architects with a small addition. So we're incredibly excited. It has been a long journey. It has been, it's just been so rewarding. It's almost like we've had lots of setbacks and, you know, a pandemic to add to it to delay the opening. But we are so happy to be now at a stage where we're sharing our collection and now have a double height exhibition space to show off exhibitions such as Amelia's. It gives us an enormous opportunity to dream and expand and plan for the future. So the building itself is wonderful. It's a heritage site. It's a museum. It has had a long history of being from a 13th century monastic settlement through to being a army site for 100 years and an almshouse for 150 years before it became a museum. And consequently, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to open our exhibition, our first contemporary exhibition with Amelia's show, to honour the Defence Forces and to make a to really honour the past use of the building. So it was a perfect union of Amelia's terrific body of work and finding a really great place as our first opening exhibition.
So I know before you've always had very exciting exhibitions in the Butler Gallery when it was in Kilkenny Castle. But what does it mean you can do now in relation to putting other work on show as well as a wonderful exhibition like Amelia has?
Absolutely. Now, we have a space now that's almost 6 metres high, which is, while the galleries in Kilkenny Castle were more domestic in scale, sort of similar more to the collection exhibitions that we have now in Evans Home, it just provides us with flexibility to offer shows to artists who make big work, but also media film installations. We wouldn't have had the opportunity to do things like present the Irish premiere of Incoming, Richard Moss's exhibition that followed his big success at Venice a number of years ago. So he's going to feature next year. Our next show will be our third collaboration with Cartoon Saloon on Wolfwalkers. And then that's more of an installation. You can really create a whole installation feel in a larger space. But we've also got movable walls that can recreate some of the intimacy we had at Butler Gallery in Kilkenny Castle. So it really provides us with flexibility. And then all of our auxiliary, all the other spaces that we had to do everything in the gallery. We had to run our learning and public engagement program in the gallery. We now have a dedicated learning centre sponsored for the first year by St. Canice's Credit Union here in Kilkenny to be able to have workshops and lectures and talks. So It really expands our programming and our possibilities for bringing people in.
Absolutely. Just some of the people, I don't know if you chose them or were they chosen for you. There is like Private Oisin Roach. He's wearing night vision goggles, looking ready for action. He's a very slightly frightening looking character. Tell us about him.
Well, he was one of a pair of a recce crew. And they were two very extremely nice guys, actually, and very easy to work with. And Sergeant John Collins, who is the other part of that pair, was somebody who was introduced to me by Rosanna White, and we talked through the concept. So they were in 2019, but with people like that, you really just have to be very careful that every small detail of their uniform, of their gun, that they're holding everything correctly. And again, as I described earlier, they would just appear in the handball alley individually, take their place and make the photographs.
Right, so they would strike their own pose. That wasn't prompted by you.
Well, I would turn somebody or angle somebody, but there was a kind of an intuitive feeling between myself and the subject. I mean, when somebody stands to look at you, they actually know how to carry themselves.
Yes, yes, and all of the soldiers have something in their hands. Well, some of them have guns. One is the lead of the dog mascot. Another a sword, and then there's a female soldier holding a Harley. Tell us about one or two of those, Amelia.
Well, Ciara Nevin, she was the particular soldier with the Harley, and she arrived in the handball alley actually with somebody else's Harley with writing on it. And I just took a few photographs, and I realised, wait a minute here, we need to change this Harley. And she went back, got her own plain Harley, came back, stood in. And you must realise that these photographs were taken maybe three or four frames, and then the person left. So it wasn't a prolonged photo session with each person.
Yes, and you use film. Was that important for you to use a camera with film?
It's always important. For me, I work on film, and I try to make every shot count or every frame count. So I don't think on film. In this particular project, I used a Hasselblad on a tripod. So you're talking directly at each person who comes in. And you make light meter readings, and you talk with them, and then make a decision about the posture that they're in, and three or four frames taken, and that's that particular session. So it wasn't long periods of time moving people around. It was just a very easy communication with people who really understood why they were doing this project.
Anna, well, what pieces stand out for you in The Bloods?
There's so many of them, but when Amelia was talking there, it made me realise that she's, you know, what she has done with this group of photographs is that she's really telling a narrative, a story about the roles the men and women take. And it's so rich in its history. So you really get a sense individually. It's kind of hard to explain that, oh, it's a simple black and white portrait. But by the time you get through the whole exhibition, you get a sense of the personalities and the jobs and the hard work that's involved in being in the Defence Forces of Ireland. Of course, I'm fond of Fionn the mascot, and we hope to have him there with his handler tomorrow. And also, we're planning to do some live drawing classes with him in the gallery, physically distant live drawing classes, so that people can draw. Fionn is a beloved mascot for the
Bloods. Fionn, the dog mascot.
The dog, yes.
And this kind of exhibition, obviously, this is now flying a flag of the type of exhibitions that will be on in The Butler, accessible exhibitions while of a high artistic quality.
Well, you know, really, for the first year, I have been thinking about Kilkenny, either Kilkenny artists or Kilkenny, material that was reflective of the building or our county, just in celebration of the opening year. Richard Moss he was supposed to be here showing in August, but because of the delays, we've had to postpone that till next year. But we're going to have several painting shows next year. With Cartoon Saloon, that's always so well received.
Indeed.
And a great response from people locally. But as usual, the programming is fairly eclectic. We will continue to highlight solo shows by emerging artists. That has been how we've positioned ourselves in the past, and will continue. It just gives artists more of a scope regarding the space, and then we will see how things will evolve over time. We need to live in this building for a while. The building itself is breathing and settling down, and I think thematically and idea-wise, we will also have that opportunity to dream. But the programming is pretty much in set for the next year, and I hope people will come and visit.
We look forward to seeing the various exhibitions, and good luck with the gallery opening tomorrow and the launch of the exhibition. That's Anna O'Sullivan, director of the all-new Butler Gallery in Kilkenny, which has now moved from its previous home at Kilkenny Castle down to Evans' home on John's Quay in Kilkenny City. Very best wishes as well to photographer Amelia Steen, whose exhibition The Bloods will open the new Butler Gallery tomorrow.
I'm talking long days, summer nights, rolling over to the next, blue lights through my window, help me to to come down. Always feel at home with you. Could never feel alone with you. Na 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 na. No one understands how it feels to be with you. And I'm never looking back no more. They said we had nothing but we had it all. Shouting up the flats from the rooftop. Shouting up the flats from the rooftop.
Up the flats. That's the new single by Jimma Dunleavy. Dublin Fringe Festival is set to help bring live theatre back to the city next month, as its Pilot Light edition stages 107 performances at 23 venues in outdoor spaces and online. Fringe 2020 will feature performances at the Abbey Theatre, Project Arts Centre and Dríocht, which will be opening their doors for the first time since lockdown began in March. I'm joined now by Ruth McGowan, the festival director, to tell us more. I mean, that's some achievement, getting the venues open. And how did you do that?
Well, a lot of partnership, a lot of collaboration. So our venue partners said a lot of yeses when we really needed to hear them to get the festival up and running. And so we've been working towards this day, our day when we get to share our programme with everyone for a long couple of months. So it's exciting to be able to talk about it all.
So venues like the Abbey and Project, for example, how can you approach them to make them safe for audiences, given that they're closed?
Well, those venues have also been putting their plans in place about how to safely reopen. The arts industry has had a very tough year.
Indeed.
And everyone's really keen to find a way to adapt so that lots of the artists' ideas can meet an audience again and get us back to that sort of thrill of live performance in a safe way.
All right. Can you give us an idea, like what have the Abbey done, for example?
Sure. So across all of our venues, they won't look like they used to. So you won't go in and be seeing, rows of empty seats. What we've tried to do is work with the venues to find a way to keep the performance energy, that the audience can see each other as well as the performers, and have that sensation that we're all missing of being in a room, having a shared experience with other people. So some venues are approaching it by doing cabaret style seating, where households can sit together but leaving lots of space between other patrons, whereas other venues that we have different approaches to having everyone sitting separately and in their own space.
So the festival is promising to keep her lit. So is that a kind of a midway between last year's festival and next year's, or is keeping it lit quite an ambitious programme?
I think it's an ambitious programme. The idea comes from, we're calling this year's festival the Pilot Light Edition. So in the kind of innocent days of March, we were thinking, oh, Fringe will be like the party at the end. We're going to be able to, we'll be through the worst of it and we'll be able to kind of do the festival as usual. But when it became clear that that wasn't going to be possible, we asked, we did some consultations with artists. We asked them what they thought we should do. And overwhelmingly, they said, we want to make work. We want to make shows, and that parameters are actually a really useful part of a creative process, that they can open doors to kind of new avenues of thought, that they can present new perspectives. And so they presented us with some brilliant ideas. So we thought, we've got to find a way to do this. So yes, it is about keeping the pilot light on in terms of creativity, but also the festival itself.
And now we've talked about the conventional venues, but you're using some very large outdoor spaces. Dalymount Park and Dublin Castle. Dalymount Park is going to be the home of comedy.
That's right.
So, and we're used to dank little basements for comedy. Now they're going to the home of bohemians.
That's right. So we're doing a series of stand-up comedy gigs called Comedians in Bohemians, where we're building a stage in the stands so that the audience are seated in the stands. The historic pitch is the backdrop, and it gives some really brilliant, beloved comedians a chance to get back in the game and do some gigs again after a couple months off.
And then Dublin Castle, what's going to be there?
And so we're building an outdoor stage in Dublin Castle also, and we will have circus performance and cabaret performance in those spaces. And it's actually really iconic city centre spaces that not a lot of people spend time in. So it's lovely. It has that kind of secret feel as well when you're in there.
And then there's things people can, well, not go to, but things people can do without leaving their own home or perhaps their own garden. There's something called miniature meadows.
Yes. So for a lot of people, we understand that being in public spaces and certainly enclosed public spaces might still feel a ways off. And Fringe is for everyone. So we wanted to make sure we could reach audiences who were still staying at home or staying local. And so the artists have responded to that with one project that's called 1,000 Miniature Meadows, which comes to you through a letter in the post. And inside the letter, you'll get a set of instructions and a set of items that'll take you on a journey, on a walk in your neighbourhood. And over the course of that project, which is a planting project, 1,000 miniature wildflower meadows will be planted in Ireland, which is a really beautiful project by Shanna May Breen and Luke Casserly are the artists.
Now, on to some of the shows. Malaprop is returning to Before You Say Anything.
Yes. So we're working together with the Abbey Theatre and we've commissioned Malaprop, who are a really brilliant, exciting Irish theatre company, to make a piece of work bespoke for the Chapel Royal in Dublin Castle called Before You Say Anything. And they're investigating the idea of the danger of safety and how everyone can be safe at the same time.
Right. And also Fish Amble, other well-known names, is on the programme.
Yes. So in the Peacock, we have Mustard by Sunday's Child in association with Fish Amble. And that show won a Fringe First in Edinburgh last year. And Sunday's Child are frequent collaborators of Dublin Fringe. So we're thrilled to have the Dublin premiere of Mustard.
And then there's Glitter Hole.
Yes, part of a project called Utopia or Bust, Manifestos for a New Era. We have commissioned three sets of peerless Irish artists, so collectives that are real trailblazers, to write manifestos for the world that they want to return to post-pandemic.
And will they be performed then, or are they written documents?
They're written documents and beautifully designed. So there's a chapter of our print brochure that has all of those manifestos, but they'll also be displayed in public space in Dublin and in Paris during the festival dates with our partner, the Centre Culturel Irlandais in Paris, and at Project Arts Centre in Temple Bar.
Well, it all sounds very exciting, and isn't it great to have the theatres open? That's the Dublin Fringe Festival from September the 5th to the 20th. Details on fringefest.com. And Ruth McGowan, thank you very much for talking to us. That's it for tonight's Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGraw was on sound, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan.